G'day, gladdies and potties and tweet hearts and stickies, and welcome to another Best of LNL on RN Summer. Welcome, beloved listeners, to Late Night Live. From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent. Behind that line lie all the capitals of the ancient states of Central and Eastern Europe: Warsaw, Berlin, Prague, Vienna, Budapest, Belgrade, Bucharest, and Sofia. All these famous cities and populations around them lie in what I must call the Soviet sphere, and all are subject, in one form or another, not only to Soviet influence, but to a very high, and in many cases, increasing measure of control from Moscow. Thus spake Winston Churchill in Missouri on the 5th of March 1946, when in a sense he sort of declared the Cold War off and running, and unveiled the term of the Iron Curtain. It's a vivid image, isn't it? And while all of Europe had to face the enormous task of rebuilding, mass migration, including a lot of ethnic cleansing of German-speaking populations in Eastern Europe, everyone trying to get life back on track, the peoples were faced with the additional challenge of Stalinism. And the conversion of these countries to communism, to Stalinism, was achieved with remarkable haste. Now, the standard narrative, the one that I believed in as a teenage Bolshevik, was that the East was freed from the yoke of Nazi Germany, that the populations rejoiced as Soviet troops arrived to liberate them. And yes, they did. The Soviets did free millions. They opened the gates of the concentration camps. They emptied Gestapo prisons. And they allowed Jews to leave their hiding places. But for many, this period is remembered as the brutal beginning of a new occupation. Anne Applebaum is an historian and journalist, regular columnist for the Washington Post and for Slate. Anne's director of political studies at the Legatum Institute in London. Let me ask you in parenthesis, the Legatum, what's that?
It's a small think tank, which is the piece of it that I work on is to do with studying, comparing, working on questions of political transition.
And
not the same as the topic of this book, but.
And legatum means what?
It means legacy in Latin.
Ah, silly me.
It's the name of the founders. The founders chose.
Well, and divides her time between the Institute in London, between Britain and Poland, where her husband, Radek Sikorski, serves as foreign minister. Anne's book, Gulag, A History, won the Pulitzer in 2004, and her latest is called Iron Curtain, The Crushing of Eastern Europe, 1944 to 1956. And I'm delighted to say that she's actually in the Sydney studio. Normally, Anne, I'm just speaking to the empty air and to a voice in the headphones.
Well, I'm glad to actually be here in that case.
Welcome to our little wireless program. Now, at the end of World War II, the Soviet found itself in control of 8 different countries. Now, at first, as you point out, they moved softly, softly.
Quite softly, not so softly. It's very clear when you read the documents and when you read what was going on in 1943 and 1944 as the Red Army came into this region, that they were very clear about what they intended to do. They didn't quite know how long it was going to take or what the exact outcome would be on a given day. But they were interested in Sovietizing or communizing or whatever verb you want to use right from the very beginning. Actually, you read at the beginning the famous Churchill quote, which is from 1946. By 1946, the leaders of the Polish Home Army, the resistance leaders, had been arrested. The beginnings of the destruction of civil society had already taken place in Hungary. quite a few steps that we think of as steps towards the Cold War or towards Soviet occupation had already happened. I mean, a lot of things happened right at the beginning.
And this is at a time when they were incredibly hubristic, and the long-term goal was worldwide revolution.
It was worldwide revolution, and that to them didn't seem ambitious, because that was what Marx said was going to happen, or Marxist-Leninism said was going to happen, and so they assumed that was correct. That's what there would be.
What was the occupation of the Baltic states a template for the for Eastern Europe?
The invasion of Eastern Poland and the Baltic states in 1939 was a kind of template. So the Soviet Union had the experience already of taking over different countries and Sovietizing them. And some of the lessons they learned in 1939 in Poland and in the Baltic states, they then reapplied later in 1945 when they came back into that region. So,
and of course they trained a lot of East European communists in the camps, hadn't they?
They began the training of what became the Polish secret police begins in, as I say, 1939, not 1945. And they also began training communists from all over the region during the war, or before the war even.
Go forth and multiply. Now, even though many Poles welcomed the Soviet soldiers, it was a culture shock. I remember John Lukacs on the program talking about the dark, round Mongol faces with narrow eyes, incurious and hostile.
The perceptions of the Russians in the beginning was very much of an alien invasion. You know, it was many of the Russians who came into the region were angry. They'd been fighting since Stalingrad. They weren't quite sure what kind of countries they were coming into. They expected hostility. When they came into Poland, or when they came into Hungary, they assumed they were coming into fascist countries, and they were fighting fascists. And that was true really almost as soon as they left the Soviet Union.
There's a revelation on every other page in your book, Anne, and one of them I found intriguing was that the Russians had been told of the poverty, unemployment and misery of capitalism and the superiority of their own state. But on entering Eastern Poland, then one of the poorest parts of Europe, they found peasants who owned several chickens, cows and more than one change of clothing.
That was a revelation, and it made some of them extremely angry. They got into Eastern Poland, and let alone when they arrived in rich cities like Budapest or Berlin, they were confronted with direct contradiction of everything they'd been taught. These people were rich. They were more successful. Even the peasants were richer. Even the poor people were richer than Russian poor people. And they searched for ways to explain it. And sometimes they explained it as it's because they stole from us. You know, it's because
Did they use that to justify the pillage that they perpetrated?
They used it to justify the pillage, and I think it inspired a lot of anger. And whether that anger was anger at their own system, or anger at the Germans, or anger at the nations they were conquering, it was. I'm not sure that it was that well defined, even to the people who.
But there would have been some blowback towards Moscow.
And Moscow was very afraid of that, actually, and that's why there were the soldiers who came back from and others who'd been in the West during the war and afterwards were objects of great suspicion upon returning.
And many would pay the ultimate price for that.
Many did. There were particularly anybody who'd been in captivity of any kind, anybody who'd been in a prison camp, prisoner of war camp, anybody who'd been a slave laborer in Germany. They went through, on their way back into the Soviet Union, they went through filtration camps where they were ideologically observed and checked and so on, and some of them didn't pass the test and they wound up in the gulag.
Which you wrote about so memorably. Now, of course, war also normalized the plunder, the looting and the violence. I didn't realize that even the fields around Treblinka were dug up by treasure hunters in 1946.
Which was very common in all kinds of places. I mean, digging up grave sites, whether it was Jews or Poles or anybody else, was quite common. Actually, we have a house in Western Poland, and there's what looks like it used to be a graveyard, probably of Germans near us, has also been dug up.
And you describe gangs roaming the countryside, sometimes calling themselves resistance fighters, when they had no connection to anybody.
Well, this is a very tragic moment. You have, and this is really a Polish story, but it also is true in Hungary and to some extent in Czechoslovakia. You had people who had been sometimes very bravely fighting the Germans in previous years. And they'd been living in the forest. They'd been partisan units. They were to some degree organized and to some degree, and certainly they were loyal to the London, the governments in exile. And then the war ended and they were still objects of suspicion and hatred. The Red Army was searching for them and trying to kill them. And there was a confusing moment where people were beginning to stop fighting and many people wanted the war to be over, but there were still these young men who were interested in independence. What should they do? Some continued to fight the Russians for a while. Some gave up. It was a very difficult and hard for people to understand what was going on.
It's funny, a couple of weeks ago we did a program on the, to my surprise, was mass AWOL, mass desertions from the Western armies. And many of the soldiers who shot through established criminal gangs in major European cities.
Mm-hmm.
And organized, huge black market operations. In other words, at any time of political upheaval and dislocation, it would be mad not to expect these outcomes.
No, it was seems like modern Afghanistan. People still had weapons. The markets were not established. The currency wasn't established. At some point, there were all different kinds of currencies circulating. Legal order was not established. Nobody knew exactly who was in charge. There was absolutely a period of transition after the war that was complicated and bloody, and it was when enormous feelings of revenge and anger were played out against the Germans and others. It was a very difficult time, and it's not a well-remembered time in those countries or really anywhere else.
You're right that the widespread destruction of everything condemned millions to what you describe as radical loneliness.
People were cut off. They were not sure to what country they belonged. Everything they had previously believed in had proven not to be true.
I should put in parenthesis, often they couldn't relate to the country in which they found themselves because the borders had been changed.
The borders had moved. The towns they grew up in were no longer Polish, or they were no longer part of the country they'd been living in. All their relatives were dead. They had nothing. They'd been fighting in the woods, or they'd been in labor camps, or they'd been in hiding for the previous several years. They were behind in their education. They had nothing to show for their lives. And they were disoriented. And some concluded, as I explained in the book, that the fault was the pre-war regimes, that the democracy and liberalism and capitalism had failed. They had failed to prevent this war. They had failed to prevent Hitler. And they began looking for some other ideology or some other explanation.
Hence the totalitarian personality.
Hence the initial attraction of some people for totalitarian communism, which was brought in by the Red Army.
So they found a perverse sense of security in the proximity to the Soviet secret police.
Some people found, it wasn't so much the secret police, but they found the ideology comforting. It was internationalist, so it was anti-Nazi, it was anti-fascist. It explained everything in a very comforting way. It said what was going to happen next. It explained how the course of history was now going to go. And there were people who found that ideology extremely attractive.
Of course, all the leaders of East European countries were the so-called Moscow communists, trained by the Soviet, as opposed to communists who made their careers within their own countries.
Yes, it's a very important distinction, actually. So that many of in the immediate post-war period, the communists who initially came to ultimate power were people who Stalin trusted, and he trusted them because he knew them, because they'd spent the war in Moscow. There were a number of different scenarios, but they were some people who were somehow known to Moscow, and actually they and the Russians were very suspicious and very dubious about people who said they were communists but who'd somehow spent the war in fascist Germany or in occupied Poland, because those people weren't trustworthy. Maybe they'd been collaborators. Maybe they were secretly capitalists. Maybe they were traitors. We didn't know what they were doing.
This, to some extent, plays itself out even in 1956 in Hungary, doesn't it, where you've got, what to many of us in the party at the time was a conflict between party factions.
Well, 1956 was more than that. 1956 was there was a conflict between party factions, and then in addition to that, it became an anti-communist revolution. So it was more than a conflict between party factions.
So the leaders of East European countries trained as Moscow communists, but the Soviet and East European communist parties pursued their goals using violence.
They did use violence. They used not mass violence and not indiscriminate violence, but they used very selective violence.
Attacking the ministries of interior and defense, for example.
Well, there was more than that. They targeted intellectuals. They targeted priests. They targeted local leaders. They targeted former policemen. They were looking for people who were in some way leaders or who were capable of creating new institutions and organizations. And they didn't always kill them, but they, one way or another, attempted to repress them, undermine them, arrest them, prevent them from doing their job.
How did the authorities, particularly the Russians, decide who and who was not an authentic, genuine fascist?
Oh, it was very subjective. A fascist could be someone who owned a lot of property, or a fascist could be somebody who wasn't sufficiently pro-Soviet. So many of the anti-fascist trials that took place immediately after the war in some of these countries were not accepted then or later by people as genuine because they were indiscriminate.
And who were the werewolves?
The werewolves were young Germans, young Hitler youth who had supposedly, some genuinely, but mostly in theory, been trained at the end of the war to fight the Soviet occupation when it came. So in other words, Hitler was preparing for the post-war, the loss of the war to the Soviet Union, and he the United States, and he trained young people who were meant to fight as underground against the Russians. The problem was, in practice, there were very, very few of them.
So the Soviets would arrest people who looked wealthy or because they had books or shortwave radios. And this could be kids as young as 15.
It could be kids as young as 15. And in fact, if anything, they were more suspicious of young people than of old people.
Why?
Because they were very interested in the future. And they saw young people as the element of society that could be shaped. You know, well, these old people, they're going to keep on going to church, and there's a limited amount we can do with them, and we won't change them. But young people, they believed to be malleable, and they would be able to convert them, and they would be able to shape them. And they were very concerned from the beginning, from 1945 or 46, they were very concerned about what kinds of youth organizations were being formed. And they were anxious to have some control over those and shaping those. And they were worried about that even before they were really worried about political parties. So it was something they did right away.
Was the party at that time difficult to join? Were they pretty fussy about who they recruited?
Not initially, they were not so fussy. I mean, it was a little bit different from country to country, but initially they were quite anxious to get any members.
I would have thought that the first thing a young person or anyone would try and do would be to sign up for the Communist Party to give them a degree of security.
Many people had exactly the opposite reaction. I mean, many people did have such a reaction. Many young people immediately tried to form their own organizations. They were suspicious of Russian intentions, and they weren't sure that they wanted to be communists, which were from the beginning in almost every country perceived as being somehow pro-Russian. And they were anxious to form their own groups, and sometimes they were anxious to form groups based on, you know, that had some continuity from before the war. So the Poles immediately began to reform their scouting movement, which was an incredibly important piece of sort of activity in Poland. And in Germany, people immediately began to reform church groups. And so the young Christian Democrats in Germany in 1945 and 1946 were very important. And it turned out actually that was a very dangerous thing to be a young Christian Democrat, because that was one of the organizations that was most severely repressed.
Of course, let's look at Poland, a country of particular interest to you. There were a great many people in Poland who, to more greater or lesser degree, collaborated with the Nazis, and yet some of them would make it through to the New World.
That's a very controversial statement, and there were clearly some people collaborate in any context. Poles collaborated and French collaborated and so
True.
On. I mean, and Poland is unique in having not had a collaborationist government.
There was no Vichy.
There was no equivalent of Vichy, and there was also quite a big resistance movement from early on in the war. It was, I think, the second largest after Yugoslavia.
How important was Catholicism to that?
To resistance.
Yeah.
It's important because of the very long tradition and the very long role of the church in during occupied Poland, which is really from since the 19th century, and during the war and after the war. The church played literally as a physical institution and also as a sort of intellectual home for a traditional idea of Polishness. So during the communist period, when I was there in the late 1980s, churches were literally a place where people could meet that was sort of neutral and non-governmental. And during the war and after the war, the church was a place of refuge, and it was also a kind of place where different ideals were supposed to be, different ideals and a different idea of society was protected. So the idea of the continuity of history, and that there's that Marxism is not the last and final word on everything. The church was one of the institutions in Poland and also elsewhere, in Hungary and Czechoslovakia, that preserved a different idea of society.
This is LNL on RN Summer, and Pulitzer Prize winning author Anne Applebaum was talking to me in May this year about her book Iron Curtain, The Crushing of Eastern Europe, 1844 to 1956. Let's go back to the term fascist, which, as you point out, in true Orwellian fashion, was used to describe anti-fascists who also happened to be anti-communist. In other words, it was a very useful brand to stick on someone.
It's one of the things I think people find hardest to understand about the Soviet entry into Eastern Europe. Who were the first people they arrested in many countries, Poland in particular, because it was a larger group of people, but many of the first people they arrested were the anti-fascists, the people who'd been hiding in the woods, the people who'd been partisans, the people who'd been somehow active against Hitler's regime. It's true in Hungary, too. Why? Well, because they were, people who'd been capable of organizing themselves against the Germans clearly would be capable of organizing themselves against the Russians. And so they were often the first people to be arrested.
Going back to Orwell, as you point out, the type of thought control and censorship employed throughout the communist East can't be replicated. The internet has made sure of that. So why is it still important that we explore this period? And I acknowledge that we haven't explored it very well at all. I had Timothy Snyder on the program talking about Bloodlands. And as he pointed out, the history in the East has been remarkably overlooked by Western historians.
There are a number of things that interest me about this period, but that are also more general interest. But so if I were to pick one or two, I would say the Soviet style totalitarianism, in other words, the attempt to control everything, the attempt to control not just politics and not just economics, but also culture and the arts and children's after-school activities and summer camps and so like everything to be under the control of the state, was an idea that spread. And it spread partly because the Russian, the Soviet secret police had ways of spreading it. They literally ran training programs in the Arab world and elsewhere. And it also has been attractive in other places in other countries who've tried to replicate it. I mean, I don't think the idea of the total state, I mean, you say it can't happen anymore. I wonder about that. I mean, the internet is it's simply another form of communication, and we don't know yet if people will find ways of controlling
it. Whether it can be subverted.
Whether it can be subverted, and there are certainly governments who are trying, as we know.
Yeah. You point out that among the great myths about the international communist movement, or that it propagated about itself, was that it was indifferent to national and ethnic distinctions. It's total twaddle, isn't it?
Well, Stalin was obsessed with ethnicity and national distinctions, and he tried to play games with nationalism, and he played with nationalism a good deal. Part of the rationale for redrawing the Polish border was that it would make the Poles more nervous. If some of their territory had been former German territory, then they would be reliant on the Soviet Union to defend them from Germany. The ethnic cleansing that was carried out after the war all over the region was largely led by either by local communists or sometimes directly by the Red Army.
Well, we should point out to the listener, if they don't know this, that millions of Germans had been involved in colonizing Eastern Europe, even if they were not Nazis, had to pack up and piss off, didn't they, in a hurry?
Well, and some who had been there for many centuries. I mean, it was some had been moved in with the Nazis because the Nazi resettlement policy was much more complex than we usually remember. And some had been there always. Many of these were mixed regions, and some of what became Western Poland had actually been German for many centuries.
Why did the Czechs speak of the wild expulsions in 1945?
Because the initial expulsions from Czechoslovakia, from a region called the Sudetenland, the initial expulsions were literally spontaneous. There were it was a form of vengeance and revenge taking for the war. You saw some of this in France. You saw this almost everywhere after the Germans left. And they went to the houses of Germans and they threw them out of the houses and they told them to leave. And it was really that simple. So there was vengeance. There was a spirit of anger against the Germans and a desire to take revenge.
And of course, all this had the approval of the Western Allies, including Churchill.
The expulsion of the Germans absolutely had the approval of the Western Allies. I mean, later on, it was more regulated and better organized than it was in the first few days. But it was in the Potsdam Treaty.
With the Red Army doing the dirty work.
The Red Army did the dirty work in the parts of the world that it occupied. Yes, or sometimes local communists.
You point out how violent Eastern Europe was after the war. Quote, dangerous to be a communist official, dangerous to be anti-communist, dangerous to be German, dangerous to be Polish in a Ukrainian village, dangerous to be Ukrainian in a Polish village. And, of course, it remained very dangerous to be Jewish.
It could be very dangerous to be Jewish, to come home from the war to communities that had been severely damaged and were run by semi-criminal gangs, as you pointed out before, and to want to claim your property back. Not everybody wanted them to have their property.
But that wasn't so much an official policy of anti-Semitism.
No, there was no official. On the contrary, there were no official policies of anti-Semitism. But this is a period of enormous conflict and anger, and there were Jews who came into conflict with others in their communities or with their former communities.
You quote a Polish historian, Stoller, who observed that those who benefited in material ways from the destruction of the Jews felt guilt-ridden and would seek to justify their actions.
He was writing more generally about the Holocaust and about how it didn't the people who'd witnessed it didn't necessarily come away with it with the, you know, none of us have had the experience of witnessing or living through something like the Holocaust, so it's hard for us to imagine. But he was speculating that people who had witnesses didn't necessarily come out of it feeling the way we might expect them to, that some of them were angrier, some of them thought maybe the Jews had deserved it, or some of them needed to, you know, explain why they, to themselves, why they hadn't done anything, and they said, oh, well, the Jews had it coming to them. So there was the ways in which people spoke to themselves about it afterwards were not necessarily what we would expect now from our perspective, looking back on it 60 years later.
I remember that quite a few of the heavies in the Hungarian Communist Party were Jews, and Rákosi, himself a Jew, gave a speech at a mass rally denouncing, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, speculators. He said those who speculate, who would undermine the economic foundations of our democracy, should be hung on the gallows, and this accompanied Hungarian Communist Party posters featuring caricatures of speculators looking rather like the ones that were, you know, deployed in Nazi Germany in the 30s.
The Hungarian Communist Party had a special problem in this period because its leaders were all Jewish. And in order to deflect anti-Semitism or deflect dislike of themselves, they sometimes used anti-Semitic rhetoric, which is one of the more bizarre twists of communist and post-Holocaust history. That was really coming from them.
Stalin's right-hand man in Poland, a Jew, Berman, learned in 1942 his brother had been gassed at Treblinka, and he put up a stoic front. But why were these communists so uneasy about Jewishness?
I mean, first of all, I'm not sure I would call Berman Stalin's right-hand man. That's a separate thing. But they, you know, often there was an ideological reason, which was that they were trying to hew to the idea that communism was an international movement and not a national movement. And that they, you know, they needed to speak in international language. And also there was a feeling that, you know, the Holocaust was really the secondary issue. You know, that really there's a letter you know, a couple of letters. I think it's one from Berman who writes to a friend in this period about how we shouldn't talk too much about the Holocaust because it's really a secondary issue. The primary issue is defeating the Germans and installing communist regimes. So there's a desire to play it down for that reason. And then more generally to deflect attention from themselves.
Let's look at the evisceration of civic society, which you were mentioning earlier, because it's heartbreaking to read about the destruction of so many groups, political parties, church groups, young people's organizations, women's groups. I mean, heavens above, even organizations like the YMCA, the Scouts movement in Poland, were seen as a threat.
Any spontaneous organization that was not somehow submissive to the state was considered suspicious, no matter what it did. So it was not only political organizations, but charity organizations, church organizations, all kinds of organizations.
Couldn't say the Scouts put up their hands and say, we'd like to become young pioneers?
They didn't want to be young pioneers. They wanted to be Scouts. And there was a long tradition of scouting in Poland. And it had its own, of course, for dating back to before the First World War. And so there was a tradition of scouting and of, you know, a certain kinds of oaths they took and customs they had and traditions and so on. And they didn't want to initially ditch all those and join the Communist Party.
I suppose this comes back to the point you made earlier about the anxiety concern with youth, because other groups that were deemed to pose a threat were people's colleges, which I learned from you were formed to educate kids of peasants. Fencing groups, folk dancing groups.
Mm-hmm. The ideology of these regimes was that every organization should be under their control. There should be no spontaneous formation of any kind of group or association in society. And that's actually, turns out, when you look at the history of this period, to be a lot more fundamental to Soviet communism than we usually think. We usually think about nationalization and so on, you know, which is all part of, that all happened as well. But this desire to control society is something they showed from the very beginning and maintained.
Was it more comprehensive than what we observed in Nazi Germany?
It was similar. There were a lot of similarities. That's probably the central similarity between Nazism and communism. The Hitler Youth movement. You know, you can see many echoes. The difference is that the Soviet Union had more time. You know, it was these regimes lasted a lot longer, and the effort to totalitarianize, I don't know if that's a word or if I just made it up.
It's a very good word.
I can't think of a better. The effort to do that, they had a longer amount of time to do it, and they had more. They were able and they were in control for longer. The Nazis didn't get that far.
You're listening to LNL on RN Summer, program from May this year. My guest, historian and author Anne Applebaum. I want to get on now to the control of the media, but first of all, I need to understand something. What media was left around Eastern Europe in 1945?
Well, not much is the answer. There had been, in different countries, the situation a little different, but it all had to be refounded and restarted in 1945. Newspapers were refounded to the extent that there was paper.
Radio, of course, could.
The most interesting medium in that period is the radio, and it's the one
Goebbels kept saying.
Absolutely, and this is the one absolutely that the Russians were by far the most interested in. And sometimes they set up one of the first buildings they occupied in East Berlin. Actually, it wasn't in East Berlin. In Berlin in May 1945 was the radio station. They took it over. They prevented it from being damaged. And they reopened it 2 weeks after the final Nazi broadcast, and they began broadcasting in German, describing their victory. So, and they cared about it, and actually it's interesting why they cared about it, because they believed the radio was the medium that reached the masses, in other words, the workers and the peasants, and the people whom they believed would support them. So if we can just get onto the radio and we can tell people what they wanted, who we are, they'll support us, and that was why they cared about the radio. They were less interested in newspapers and intellectual magazines and so on. You know, all that would come later.
You know, it's interesting. I spent some years trying to get a film school established in Australia, and when we finally succeeded, the first director was Jerzy Toplitz, who was a Polish gentleman of considerable reputation. But in the process of sussing out the history of the film school, I discovered that it was Lenin who opened the first one, Vagik, in Moscow. He could see that this newfangled film industry was going to be a damned important way of making friends and influencing people. But there really wasn't much of a film industry in Europe, was there, in 45?
Well, not in 1945, because there was too much destruction.
Didn't stop the Italian neo-realists, but don't take your point.
Not that long afterwards, actually, by the late 40s, by the end of the 40s, you began to have film production in this region. I remember Hungary had been one of the biggest and most advanced producers of movies before the war, as had Germany.
And Poland became so later.
It took Poland longer to get started because the level of destruction, really of everything in Poland, was so much greater.
It's wonderful, though, when I think back on the golden age of Polish and indeed Czech cinema, how incredibly subversive and encoded these films could be, you know, really giving the finger to the Stalinists, but doing so subtly.
I've had several people describe this to me, that they always attempted to make points without dialogue, because that way they would escape censorship. So many things were done with images or pictures, or people's facial expressions were used to show things or explain things in the movies that might not have been even understandable to people who weren't somehow in the know and knew what the commentary was. And that was true of theater, and it was also true of the movies, absolutely, in this period, and particularly slightly later in the 60s.
Years and years ago, I had Marcus Wolf on the program, you know, the Stasi spy master for 34 years, and he talked about the soft sell of communism to the masses in his program, You Ask, We Answer. Pretty hard to soft sell communism.
It's funny, I have some quotes from You Ask, We Answer in my book. The fact that Marcus Wolf, who was a very well-trained young communist, was sent from Moscow to Berlin in 1945, the fact that he was sent to work on the radio right away tells you a little bit about how important they thought the radio was. You know, this is one of their stars who later became one of the most important East German communists.
I wish I had a career path like this in radio. But I don't think it's available anymore. Look, would you be kind enough to tell me about Father Kiss, the Father Kiss conspiracy?
This was in Hungary, but there are similar examples in other places of priests who were. He was a priest who was identified as a potential. As a provocateur, and he was accused of having organized a group of young people to oppose the Soviet Union and to supposedly help supply them weapons, and supposedly those weapons were used to kill Soviet soldiers, and he was eventually arrested and condemned with really no proof at all. This is one of several conspiracies I had the opportunity to read about in the Hungarian police archives. And one of the oddities of reading about these case histories is you can find the documents of the debrief of the suspect, you know, how each interview went. And in one interview, you know, the suspect is denying everything, and then you flip the page over, and on the next page, the suspect has confessed to everything. Well, what happened between page and one and two? Well, you don't know, but you can guess.
Yeah.
Yes.
So it was a show trial, classic of the time.
They began show trials, but they began also from the beginning looking for examples, you know, looking for people who could be made examples of, who could be made, cases could be made out of people, so that as lessons for others. Selective violence was, you know, it wasn't mass machine gunning of people in the city. It was choosing people and creating cases about them. And, you know, when you arrest one person, then lots of other people are afraid.
Creating radical loneliness,
making people afraid of one another, making people afraid to speak out loud, keeping people atomized in their own
Well, when the
world.
Stasi files, you know, were sort of unlocked, the shattering thing to many East Germans was how heroes of dissidents had also been collaborators. I mean, everyone was open to that sort of coercion.
It's a hard thing to make judgments about now. I mean, it depends on the place and the time. But this period that I've written about, I began, as I was working on it, I began to sympathize or empathize with people who lived in that period, because they had very, very bad choices. You know, they, you know, people had children and they had aging mothers and they had other people to support and they had, you know, they couldn't just go off in the woods and fight so easily.
And I'm not being judgmental so much as descriptive. I entirely agree with you.
People had, you know, they attempted to get by, and they attempted to, sometimes they rationalized, you know, they tried to do this with, the, you know, they would march in the May Day parade, and then they'd go home and listen to Radio for Europe, or they would, you know, they would explain their choices to one another in different ways. But it was a very gray period. It's a very hard period in which to find heroes. I mean, there are some real villains, actually. I mean, we can find some of those, but it's hard to find heroes, and it's hard to blame the 80% of the population who somehow tried to emerge from the rubble of the war and get on with things. I think later on people had more choices by the 70s or 80s, but not in this period.
Well, your book is full of compassion, I think, for the sufferings of the region, as it has to be.
Well, it's hard from the privileged life that I and people who live in this era have had not to feel, try to feel compassion for that era. We know nothing like this.
I'd forgotten that at the end of the war, Stalin tried to encourage the formation of a coalition of democratic parties in Poland. What was he on about?
He, for a while, there were different tactics used in the region. So initially, they tried to organize coalitions. They tried to They didn't immediately come in and take over as communists. They wanted to create, what they were genuinely trying to do was win some legitimacy. And they thought they would win legitimacy by winning elections. So they expected to win elections as the Communist Party. And sometimes
the pollsters weren't very skillful, were they?
Sorry?
The pollsters weren't very skillful.
Their pollsters were pretty weak. And they were constantly surprised when they lost these elections, which they did almost everywhere.
I think Winston Churchill felt the same emotion back in the UK.
Maybe. And one of the things that the communists kept not understanding was why people didn't support them. And they kept trying to find an explanation. And sometimes the explanation was, it's because our propaganda isn't good enough and we need to do better. We need to explain it to people better. And sometimes the explanation, well, it's because they're spies. They're spies, they're saboteurs, they're Western traitors all around us. And when they came to those kinds of conclusions, then there were waves of arrest, as there was in this region again in 1949.
Anne Applebaum, you're good at phrases. We've already created a new term on this program. But tell us what you mean by high Stalinism.
High Stalinism was the only moment when, for a brief period, the communists of Eastern Europe thought they could control everything, and they could remold people, and they could make human nature different. And so this is the period in which they made enormous attempts to control the arts, to control culture, to control education, to control the media. They built cities designed to encourage the development of, you know, a kind of communist proletarian by creating architecture that would be somehow proletarian architecture. They tried to write East German communist dance music to compete with Western dance music. And this was a period when they attempted to create a kind of new civilization.
It was also a time when they built those grotesque skyscrapers all over Eastern Europe, like the one in Poland.
They built a grotesque
tiny but exquisite, it was called by the locals.
Yes, it was. It's very unfortunate that it's still there.
Is it still there? I haven't been back for a while.
It's still there. It's now somehow surrounded by other skyscrapers.
But then what's it used for these days?
It's got all kinds of institutions in it. It's a sort of big, enormous, falling down building, but it's hard to tear down for lots of reasons.
Okay, so by this time, the communists, getting back to high Stalinism, were getting impatient. The young people were taking far too long to become enthusiasts, and religious people were not dying off fast enough. And in fact, religion bubbled away beneath the surface, just waiting for a moment to get out again. Religious schools changed to state schools, the closure of monasteries. The atheistic, as an atheist, to some extent understand this, the atheistic hostility to religious education didn't play out too well.
No, it created resistance. And actually, the Russians in Eastern Europe were initially quite careful about the church because they didn't want to create a backlash, and they let it go on existing. Although they were much more concerned in the beginning about church education and church groups and organizations and so on, and only later did they really try to attack the church full on. And what they did in many cases was drive it underground and make it associated with the opposition.
Or cut a deal, as they did with the Orthodox Church in Russia.
The Orthodox Church in Russia was more than just cutting a deal. They controlled it, and they infiltrated it and controlled it. And that was, in fact, their intention in Eastern Europe as well, was to, in effect, make it into another mass organization. You know, that there would be the youth movement, and there would be the sort of pro-state, pro-communist church, and there would be, and it would be somehow under their supervision. And I have in the book some description of how they tried to do that in a few places.
Well, we're running out of time, so let's look, stay with religion for a minute, because by 1953, 1,000 priests are in the Slama in Poland. And one cardinal in particular, of course, resonates in the memory, and that's Mindszenty.
Mindszenty was a Hungarian primate who was in prison. He was arrested. He was put on show trial, and then he was imprisoned, and then he was under house arrest, and then he was let out in 1956 during the Hungarian Revolution, at which point he made a memorable speech. And after the revolution, he went into hiding, and he lived in the U.S. Embassy for many years after that.
Wyszynski, tell me about him, another cardinal, Wyszynski.
Wyszynski.
Yeah.
The Polish cardinal Wyszynski was, like Mindszenty, was also the primate. He was the head of the Polish Catholic Church in that period. And he chose slightly different tactics from Mindszenty. And one of the, I go into this in the book, the comparison of how they each tried to find some space within the state. And Wyszynski tried to, I think collaborate is not the right word here, but he tried to get along with the communists. And he did a deal with them, and he tried to somehow accommodate them in order to let the church continue to exist. He too was eventually arrested, but then he was released, and somehow he created some space for the Polish Catholic Church. Mindszenty was much more aggressively and, again, understandably anti-communist, and he protested when church schools were closed and so on. But he, in some sense, they both ultimately failed because they didn't protect all their institutions. But the Polish church did wind up with a greater hold and a greater presence in Poland.
You also point out that even in the 70s and the 80s, the churches have been deeply penetrated by the secret police.
They were, I don't know about deeply penetrated, but there were attempts to penetrate them from the beginning to the end. There were attempts to recruit priests and to make priests into pro-communists. And there were always attempts to infiltrate the church, and church people are like anybody else, and some people saw the advantage in doing that.
Meanwhile, across the other side of the world, many of the people, if not the majority, attending Communist Party meetings in the United States were members of the FBI. I like very much your theory on how communism failed, because the communists turned every aspect of society into a potential form of protest.
Well, this was the downside of totalitarianism, that if you try to control everything and you politicize everything, then you make everything into a source of potential opposition. You know, if you tell all artists, here's how you have to paint, and one person says, no, I don't want to paint that way, then you've just made him into a political opponent, even though he's doing something that in another society would be apolitical. If you tell a group of young boys, no, sorry, you can't have a scouting group, you all have to join the Young Pioneers, and they say, we don't want to do that, we're going to have our own underground scouting movement, which, by the way, was quite a big deal in Poland, then you've made them into political opponents. So it was in this attempt to control everything that was one of the sources of their ultimate demise.
So what we're perhaps seeing in Beijing these days is a bunch of commos who've learnt this lesson of history.
Certainly had to learn that lesson. I think the Chinese have altered what they do, though, because of this. And they actually do have prescribed areas where you're allowed to do what you want. And there's some freedom in the business world, and there's even some freedom in the cultural world, as long as you stay within certain bounds. I mean, the Chinese don't try to control everything anymore. And that's been, I think, probably one of the sources of their longevity.
But you also point out that the communist ideology, Marxist-Leninist economic theory, contained the seeds of their own destruction because they, well, being a religion of sorts, heaven on earth was promised. You know,
they promised people that their societies would be successful, and people understood that to mean they would be rich, and they would be richer than the West, and they never were. And actually, the differences begin at the beginning. You know, the differences between East and West Germany start to diverge by 1946 or 47. And they were never able to compete with the West, even though they grew and they developed, but not at the same pace.
I remember reading not so long ago that after the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, it took decades before industrial output was as high as it had been in the last days of the Tsars.
Absolutely, and there it remained a problem by the 70s and 80s of Soviet factories which produced things that were worth less than the raw materials that had gone into them. And so they were losing value. They were producing goods that weren't worth the things that they were made with.
How's your beloved Poland traveling at the moment?
Poland is doing remarkably well at the moment and doesn't seem to need my help or support at all.
But you're giving your help. That's why you're here.
Sort of. Poland has had, I mean, just objectively speaking, it's had a great 20 years. I mean, as I remember in the late 1980s, it was the country in the region that was supposed to do the worst and where people were the most afraid about what would happen to the economy and politics and so on. And it's been very successful. It's joined the European Union. It has a pretty steady growth rate. It hasn't had a recession even since 2008. So it's holding steady in a way that nobody really ever predicted.
And it could become the breadbasket of Europe again.
I don't know about breadbasket of Europe, but it would certainly like to be an important economic part of Europe. It's already become an important political part of Europe, and it could meet those ambitions. As I said, it's a relatively young population. It's growing relatively fast. By European standards, not by Asian standards, but and it's relatively stable.
Anne Applebaum, historian, journalist, columnist for the Washington Post and Slate. Her book, Gulag History, won a Pulitzer in 2004. That's for nonfiction. Her latest is called Iron Curtain, The Crushing of Eastern Europe, 1844 to 1956, published by Penguin. Oh, I mentioned in the interview the late Marcus Wolf. It's one of the hundreds of interviews on our archival website, In Bed with Philip. So you can look that up and have a listen to Marcus' soft selling Soviet communism. You just put in Late Night Live and In Bed with Philip into your favorite search engine. Next on the best of LNL on RN Summer, you can hear my program length chat with the delightful Magda Szubanski. See you later.